And now, it's time for the Dad Bod Rap Pod with your hosts, Damone Carter, David Ma, and Nate LeBlanc.
Dad Bod Rap Pod. We are back. It is Dim One, aka Rick Rubric, joined by the homie Nate LeBlanc, aka Sammy Semantics.
Period.
Somebody calling. And Dave Ma is on assignment, and he will be back soon. But me and Nate got this week. You think we can handle it, Nate?
Oh, I think we'll give it the old college try. Hint, hint.
Yes. Shout out to Professor Griff. I mean, Professor Ma, who's starting his class at San Jose State this week.
Which Dave is teaching hip hop history. I'm not surprised crazy in any way. I just think it's so fucking tight and amazing. I'm just overjoyed that this has come together for him. And I think these kids are very lucky to be hearing about it from such an eminent scholar, who's also just like a cool guy. Like, imagine walking into class and it's Dave with like his tattoos and his like Ramon shirt. And
he's Dave is going to bring the heat, though. I feel like Dave is going to be that professor where you think it's going to be all good. And he's like, you know, give me your top five. And then he says, shut up.
No, I think it's more like when they'll all love him until he edits one of their papers.
Papers.
It's like, you call that a lead?
Yeah. He's going to be a great professor. We're so happy for him starting that journey. We are back here in late summer, not late pandemic, full pandemic.
Full pandemic, late summer.
Full pandy, but late summer.
What is cruel summer? Why is that phrase in my head? Is that like the Good Music album? Cool. Like they did their crew album.
And they called it Cruel Summer. Oh, that's pretty dope. That?
It's like a white cover with like the Virgin Mary, and there's like a lot of Big Sean verses on there. I'm pretty sure that's a thing. Keep talking.
That was the era. Yeah, I thought you were just reaching back for Bananarama, which I'm always here for a Bananarama reference on the Dad Bod Rap Pod. But yeah, we're here. It's summertime, and I don't know about you, Nate. Actually, I do know this about you: is that certain albums correspond to certain seasons? No.
Oh yeah. Very much so. Just like certain foods correspond to certain seasons. I've probably said this on the show before, and it's almost become like a cliche in my life. I love dub reggae, especially Scientists' version of dub reggae. Like Scientists versus the Curse of the Evil Vampires is like my shit. I love that record, but I only listen to it in the summer.
Makes sense.
Yeah,
makes sense.
That's a summer record. You don't like listen to like Lee Perry like flange drums for like 20 minutes in the winter. I don't know why. Maybe because it's hot in Jamaica.
No, I was going to say there's something to be said for the environment in which the music was created. Like, I definitely feel you on dub or like a real roots reggae thing. I feel like you have to be sweating a little bit. You know what I mean? When you see those things of Bob Marley in the studio and you're like, dude, it was 90 degrees with humidity, no air conditioning.
Totally. It's you're in a mesh tank top. I'm in a mesh tank top. Let's do this.
Yes, yes. And it's definitely mesh tank top weather. Right now where we're at and really across the planet as it continues to burn up. So it got us to thinking about what are those rap albums that epitomize summer? Specifically, what is the rap album of this summer? And there have been some really monster releases that have come out.
We're in a little run here where every week it's like, oh my God, it's like so many just things I need to feel like. One, we always, you know, I hate using this term, but like we have to do our homework. Like,
yeah,
we have to listen to the new music. I want to listen to the new music, but I wouldn't listen to it in this way if we weren't doing this. But it's like, sometimes you enjoy your homework, right? It's like,
oh yeah,
it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm loving this. And we've had a couple of good release weeks in a row. We went hard on like new music last week. So we're not necessarily doing that right now, but yeah, dude, it's been a good summer. I think a lot of people had a lot of things they were holding and they got to a point where they're like, okay, we're not going to hold it anymore. And then maybe they should have, because who knows what's happening with touring and stuff. But anyway, Do I get to say my album of the summer? I've been dying since last week. Or are we gonna?
I threw out the question, and then I asked Nate to please hold his response until this time. Let's ease into it.
Okay.
Let's talk about some albums that are very good, but potentially not the album of the summer. And so I wanted to start off by bringing up a record that we talked about a little bit last week. But let's talk about it in the sense of its summer worthiness. Tyler, the Creator's Call Me When You Get Lost.
That's it for me, dude. Like that's,
That's
my album of the summer. Yeah. We did not ease into it.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to stop with that joke. I mean, to me, not only is it specifically a summer record from its art direction to its, screaming interludes to its subject matter to its videos. It's like, I don't know how else to say this except for like, it's tuned. Like Tyler, like tuned it to sound
for summer.
Like it's produced. It is summer. You know what I mean? Like that might be a little too highfalutin for me, but like, I think,
but what about it makes it, a summer record? What is the sound that really syncs up, epitomizes summer?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I like, you have to start with like a brightness, right? Like you're not gonna, like, I don't think an Aesop Rock record could be the album of the summer.
Okay, fair.
You know, like that's like a Halloween record or like a winter record. Like,
okay.
It needs to have a certain brightness of the production. And I think about this time in the Tyler record a lot when he kind of like, he obviously, this is his rapping album, and he has DJ Drama, and he does a bunch of like, you know, like people are not going to say necessarily the Two Cups of Blood Gravedigger sample is redolent of summer, right? Maybe that New York City summertime where it smells like piss for 3 weeks, but this is different. So he takes that and he brings it to LA. It's like that in that song Wilshire, they like talk about going swimming and like meeting up at the pool house. Yeah. You know what I mean? There's this part where it goes from like hard rap to like what I call Tyler's like chamber pop bag. And there's like a lot of horns and it's like kind of orchestrated and pretty. Yeah. And like, I know because I went to Lake Como in Italy, shortly before Tyler went, like, there's just this like sandals toes out like vibe. Like, it's just like, I don't know how else to describe it. Like, you know, those really cool wooden boats. What are they called? Like Chris Crafts. Like, this is like a Chris Craft rap record, if that's a thing. And I'm saying it's a thing.
You heard it from Sammy Semantics.
Yeah, they talk about being on the yacht and they're all eating ice cream and they have their toes out. Like, okay. I'm not making this up. It's all.
No. It's all in there.
Yeah. And then you have the kind of like Wes Anderson, like fur hat, passport, Gucci suitcase or whatever kind of suitcases he has. I don't understand suitcase hierarchies enough to know what suitcases he has, but it's all about his travel, his suitcases. And I think a lot of people, for traveling in the summer is like part of the rhythm of life.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a time to take vacations. Does Tyler's LA-ness factor into this? Because when I do the math in my mind, I think about a record like Haram, and I go, it's cold, it's nighttime, it has this energy that I think I assign to a lot of New York records. Are the summer records the West Coast records? Is that really all it is?
That's pretty interesting. Like Bizarre Ride to the Far Side is a summer record, right?
So summer.
I'm trying to think of like a summer East Coast record, and I think they just think of summer differently. Like, it's like you have your albums that would be played at like the outdoor basketball courts. Like, I kind of think Operation Doomsday is a summer record.
Really?
Yeah, like the 80s like Jerry Curl samples and like the kind of like I don't know. Yeah, I think that an argument could be made either way. He certainly has colder records. Like no one is saying Born Like This is a summer record.
Or Victor Vaughn, it seems like, the Dead of Winter, right?
Right.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's a strong argument to be made. We posed this question on Twitter. What was the summer album or what is the album of the summer? And yeah, definitely some folks responded Tyler. I posed the question on Twitter at Dad Bod Rap Pod before a very important record in my mind came out. And so I kind of withheld my vote until I heard it. And of course, I'm talking about the newly released Bo Jackson record, The Alchemist and Boldy James' latest LP. And we were kind of getting ready for the segment on air. And Nate, Sammy Semantics dropped a bombshell. Nate, tell us how you feel about Bo Jackson.
I'm not quite ready to make big public declarations yet, but I, on one listen, I wasn't blown away. I was very distracted while I was listening to it, though, and like I'm sure there's a lot to dig into. That's I just need to give it its time and space. But
okay,
yeah, it's like, you know, these Fridays are tough. Like we have day jobs, obviously, and yeah. Like I can't just block out 6 hours to listen to rap music. Like I have things I need to do, so I'm either walking and listening in my headphones, or like doing work on one computer and listening on the other. And I just feel like I needed to like give it its full time. But like, you know, just to contrast that and to contradict myself a little, Price of Tea in China sank in right away.
Yeah, so, no, that's why I was a little bit surprised, because you were very much an early adopter on Price of Tea in China, a record that I actually warmed to. I knew it was good. I don't think upon first listen, it hit me in the way that this record has. But I do think with Boldy, and I've been seeing a little bit of this discourse online, Salt in the Game, where I'd love to have her on at some point. She's kind of a hip hop pundit that has these really fiery takes. And she was like something to the effect of it's a boring record. It's boring. It's definitely a quiet record. It's definitely subtle. And what the amazing things that are happening are not like jumping out and smacking you in the face. So I'm one of those folks when I love something and everybody else is like, eh, I'm trying to kind of get into the mind state of like, oh, why isn't that hitting for y'all the way it is for me? But
yeah. I feel like there's a difference between subtle and boring, but they're often
it's a subtle difference
mistaken for each other by sure. People who are looking for bangers.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. My wife and I were talking about this. I'm obsessed with this record by this singer-songwriter named Lucy Dacus. It's called Home Video. I just think it's like really beautiful record. Really, it's like written from this very honest place. And like, and just like it's for me, it's one of my summer records, even though it's like really depressing.
It's been a depressing summer though.
Folky rock record. Yeah, but I'm just listening to it a ton in my free time, and I was playing it for my wife, who I also thought would like kind of get on board with it, and she's like, there's no bangers. And I'm like,
this isn't really you ruined her.
We're not in a banger economy at the moment. Like I'm like, I want you to like listen to the subtlety of this like audio short story. And like, you know, she's like kind of like, yeah, can I get some drums, you know?
Nah, son. Yeah. That's dope. So, that's anyway. So dope. I do think that Bo Jackson is possibly that record, which is so wild to me. I think if you rocked with Price of Tea in China, you know, definitely similarities. Obviously, The Alchemist and Boldy have a particular chemistry, but Boldy got better, which is like scary. And so I feel like I'm prepared to say it because I've been bumping this record for basically every day since Friday. I'm prepared to say that the Bo Jackson title is really apt, in the sense that Boldy has come out so fast, so hard, so much good material, and I think he's somehow getting better, which I don't even know how that's possible, but especially coming off records like Maindrawn McNichols' Winter Record. So I definitely kind of see where folks are coming from, but I do want to encourage, you know, if it didn't hit you the first time, I would say definitely sit with it. I really like the features. Fake Flowers is an amazing song featuring Currency and Freddie Gibbs. His joint with Benny the Butcher is
can I make my Freddie Gibbs on this joke? He raps at one point in that verse about like buying a Tom Ford shirt and pants. We all know he doesn't wear shirts. He could have saved himself like $32,000 and just bought the pants. Anyway, you're the only person I could make that joke to. I was listening to it. I was walking down the street. I can remember where I was. And I was like, why is he talking about buying a shirt? He doesn't even wear shirts.
You don't wear shirts. he's Freddie Gibbs, a very interesting character. But yeah, I think Bo Jackson is a summer record. I don't know if it's the album of the summer, but man, I'm going to withhold too much hyperbole.
Yeah, I mean, summer's not over also. We like do our like year-end best of lists in October, and that's like in like 6 weeks. So summer isn't over like by the calendar. And it's certainly still warm where we live. I don't know if that's true for everyone else, but what did the listeners have to say? What was there a consensus, or were there some
there was some
good tweets, or like what did people have to say? I'm curious.
So I posed this question, as I mentioned, on Twitter at Dadbod Rap Pod. What is the album of the summer? We got a couple of responses. We'll start with a very interesting response from Nicholas Nakonic. Your pod has me going back to appreciate old stuff more than listening to new stuff. Not the point of the program. haven't even heard of Haram yet. So Balloon, Mind State, Nia, Willie Evans, introducing, and Beauty and the Beat are mine. We talk about Beauty and the Beat a shit ton. So
yeah, I mean, those are great records. I love all those records. I'm glad that we're making people listen to those records. That makes me happy.
Yeah, no, and no diss, Nico. I feel like... I feel like we don't talk about old records all that often, but maybe we just inspire people to.
I don't think we frame segments around old records. I think we talk about old records like the way old hip hop dudes just talk about records. Like it's a constant reference point, and we're always drawing comparisons and like using to like line up our takes, kind of. You know, like those are the formative records, kind of.
Yeah, they're like it's an assume that you know and understand these records, Nico. Listen to Haram. I tell everybody and their mom.
I can't remember the name of the song, but they just performed it yesterday in Central Park in the live stream that I watched, which was awesome. And I'm so happy for everyone involved in that. By the way, if you guys are listening, you know who you are, and I'm just glad to see you shining. But like that song where Woods in particular is talking about like his time in California and mowing the lawns, like that's very summery.
No, that is a very summery tune. I will say that even the video kind of evokes some of those feels. So Haram has bright moments pitched against its perfect darkness. I love that record so much. All right, I will stop boosting for Haram for just a moment. We have T-Max iDoc chimes in with, it's a tie between Young Nudie, who I know Nate is super into, and Vince Staples. We talked a bit about Vince's record and the kind of kerfluffle behind it. Very summary record. I don't know that it's the record of the summer, but it is a very summary record.
I think it is for some people. Is it for people who like a short summer? Maybe students?
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's a short record. It's a very summary record. I'm not up on Young Nudie, but I will say this. Who did I was on our timeline, and some people said that we need to listen to Remble.
Yes.
Remble.
Remble. I did listen to some Remble.
As I did too. Gordon Ramsay freestyle.
Very interesting. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I need time with that. That's like not the kind of normal thing I listen to, but it's very interesting. And the fact that all the writer bros are into it is like very intriguing to me.
So I tried it. So I'm not to Young Nudie yet, but I definitely gave Remble a listen and like some Draco stuff. I was ready to murder last Thursday. Like I had plenty of audio ammunition going around. I just think the styles are so interesting. These weird voices that people are doing and just talking about objectively horrible things.
Yeah.
It's like if Urkel had like an AK-47. It's so interesting. I'm intrigued. I'm not saying I love it, but I was very, very intrigued.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe you should check that out. Let's go to DJ A Dizzy. For me, Tyler, the Creator's Call Me If You Get Lost is the album of the summer, if not the year. Great lyricism, great beats, and a fun throwback to the mixtape era. Mixtapes are summer, right?
That's an interesting take. Sort of.
Depends on the mixtape.
Yeah. I mean, like DJ drama style mixtapes. Like, I think those are more summer, and like trying to capture all the Lucy's and singles that would come out in a summer. Then there's, you know, your more constructed DJ mixtapes. Those have a lot of different tag, you know, just to be semantic about it. But
of course, I was going to say,
it just depends what you mean by that. But they certainly can be.
Absolutely.
I mean, a lot of your classic like DJ mixtapes are meant to evoke something. That's what they're doing. They're constructing a vibe.
Right. And a lot of times I feel like it's especially the ones in the, let's call it the New York style.
Yeah.
It just feels like for the whatever 6 weeks of good weather that they have, that it's like really compressing all that energy to be blasted.
I don't know if
Jeep.
You know this mix, but DJ 11 from Local 1200 and The Rub has this mixtape called Summer Madness that I like love. I'm like obsessed with. Like that's such a good specific summer mixtape. Just introduced me to a lot of cool artists and just is like such a good vibe of what they like might now call like open format DJing. Like there's definitely rap, there's definitely some soul stuff. It's just like such a beautiful mixtape. They just don't make them like that anymore.
Oh man, actually we're gonna have to ask you to send the penalty box for uttering that phrase. You're on dad bod timeout,
but then you'll just be talking to yourself, and where's the fun in that?
Exactly. I don't know. I'm pretty interesting. at Bird Lip says, for me, it was Evidence Unlearning Volume 1. I don't know if that's a summer record.
It's a good record, and we haven't talked about it, but that's why I brought it up. Like a total winter. Like, I don't know that he's capable of making a summer record. Like,
dude is on Venice Beach. Yeah. Like, he's literally got his feet in the sand, but it sounds wintry.
Yeah, it's like, I think he's just dour. You know, it's just like he has a dour countenance, and there's nothing wrong with that, and so do I. And so it's like, that's a really good record, though, and I feel like it came out a week we were doing something more thematic, and so we didn't really talk about it. But I have to say, it's a really, really good record from him. It's a really good record in general, but it's also, we talked to him, and he told us he was doing something different, and then he did. And I thought it was really interesting. It's like this interesting, like, back to basics, like, just take a dope beat and kill it. And like, there is nothing I like better in rap music than when people do these like stripped down versions of their deal. And it's just, he does that like consistently over the whole record and drops some knowledge and tells some stories. But what he's really doing is just rhyming his ass off. It's really good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And it did make me think back to when we talked to him and he said, I'm going to lean more into slow flow. Like, because we asked something in the vein of like, are you going to switch it up? Are we going to hear something different?
Right.
And he's like, I'm getting even more into my own bag. And that's exactly what you get on Unlearning is Evidence doing the most Evidence, maybe record to date. I really enjoyed it. And I feel like we can't forget about this in our album of the year conversations and such when we start making lists and all that. So
we
shout out to Evidence.
To be self-evident.
Ooh, that was quality. That's like when you say something real funny to Nate and he goes, that's funny. He doesn't when he don't laugh, he's just like, yeah.
Like I admire the construction of your joke.
That was definitely good. Let's do one more. Insa Mavin, Falling Out of the Sky, which is the song you're referring to from Armin Hammer.
I know the title real good.
Is the song of the summer, if that helps. Fair enough. I think, it definitely helps. I will always be grateful to Billy Woods for like capturing the energy when he says, went to California for the first time in my life. And it's like, it just opens up this whole kind of visual of your imagining the Billy Woods character. Like, and he takes you through that. And I'm like, I'm in LA. I feel like I'm from New York and I'm visiting LA for the first time in this song. It's so wonderfully, you
know,
visual.
It's like when you go to, or for me, like it reminded me of when I went to the South for the first time. And I'm like, no one ever talks about how green it is.
Yeah.
There's just like miles of grass and there's just like rivers and stuff. It's just like you hear all this stuff about like the cities. But the way he evokes that in a couple of words, in like a couple of sentences, is just really, really masterful writing.
so brilliant that we've come to expect from Billy Woods and from Armin Hammer. I think this is going to be a bit boring, but since Dave's not here, I'm going to have to agree with you.
Call Dave's me not if- here to agree with me, so exactly. You'll take that slot.
Yeah, I'm going to fill in today and say, call me if you get lost is the album of the summer. And I'll go as far as to say, I don't know this, obviously, because me and Tyler aren't friends, but I would go as far as to say that was the intent.
Yeah, it feels like it to me.
Yeah, that seemed like
about this when we talked about it before. I love his little like monologues and pep talks in there too. Like it's just so like, oh man, I really needed to hear that. Like, thank you, younger person who's so much more successful than I will ever be.
When he's like, you got to keep, you know, a picnic blanket in the back because you never know. I'm like, God damn it, I do need a picnic blanket in the back. So you know. That is probably the consensus right now.
We have declared, but there's lots of other good records right now.
Absolutely, and we'll be talking more about these as the year progresses. We're getting there, Nate. We're getting to that.
I know, final. It's almost listicle season. Like I've been talking to some people who, you know, they're like, "What's coming up next for the show?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, we're doing this, this, and that stuff I can't talk about yet." And then it's like, then it's the holidays. And then listicles. It's like, then basically we just spend the end of the year doing this kind of referendum on the previous year. And that's a couple of shows worth of stuff. And we make lists and we talk to people and we kind of like sort out what to make sense of all of this. And it's just going by so fast.
It's man, crazy. Isn't it? It's almost scary. But there's been so many good releases. So we will be ready for listicle season, but you know what we're also ready for, Nate? Testicle season. Support for Dad Bod Rap Pod is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best men's below the waist grooming champions of the world. Manscaped offers precision engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped just launched their fourth generation trimmer, which we just got in the mail, called Lawnmower 4.0. You heard that right, the 4.0. So if you know you've been shaving the jewels with 1 through 3, this is 4. Maybe the best series in hip hop history is the Lawnmower. Join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer for you. That's right, you, sir. 20% off and free worldwide shipping when you use the code DADBOD. That's right. Use the code DADBOD at manscaped.com. Nate, you, like me, got your care package in the mail. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but tell the folks about the actual machinery. Like, what is it like?
Yeah, I'll say this as a beard guy for going on probably like 15 years now. I've used a pretty wide variety of trimming and trimming products. And I have to say, it's exceptionally well designed. It's sleek. It feels good in the hand. And for me, so far, my favorite feature of the lawnmower, if indeed we are calling it that, absolutely, is it has a light on the end, like where the like kind of like fine, like I, you know, mm-hmm, I didn't use the guard or anything. I just used it for like kind of like the finer work on the cheeks and the on the neck. Having that light was extremely helpful because I can't wear my glasses when I trim my beard because that's where they meet. My head is an important part of the sideburn beard transition that needs to be handled.
Okay.
Cutting around the ears. This is so stupid, but we're now in the endorsement game and I'm going to talk about this stuff. There's those hairs that grow out of your ears that you might think are like part of the head hair. And then like sometimes one just gets super long and you just want to just nip that in the bud. So having that light, very helpful.
Okay.
I can kind of see without my glasses. It's not as dire as it is for some other people, but I would much rather have this situation illuminated because one slip,
you're
just messed up for weeks. So the manscaping tool is actually pretty damn good. Gotta say.
Yeah, it's a sleek machine. It is wireless. Charge and uses electromagnetic induction, which can help battery length last longer. So once again, get 20% off plus free shipping with the code DADBOD at manscaped.com. Your balls will thank you. And your boss should also listen to Dad Bod Rap Pod.
And we will thank you. A little less intimate, but we would very much appreciate if you guys use this promo code. We're trying to up our game here. And honestly, you know, you're probably going to need this at some point.
Part of the aging experience for our younger listeners is, as Nate mentioned, getting weird hairs in weird places that you weren't used to before. So grow up. Get yourself a lawnmower 4.0. You'll support your balls and you'll support the show, which we definitely appreciate. So I'm not sure how you transitioned from lawnmower 4.0 to an interview with the Last Emperor. So we're just going to go right in. We had the good fortune of talking to the Last Emperor, whose name I know rings bells for a lot of folks. He had, in some ways, a spectacular kind of ascent in the early 2000s, and did some really interesting things, had some really interesting stories to share, including him talking about getting a call from Dr. Dre. Nate, do you feel like we're just circling on like some kind of death row kind of retrospective? It seems like the last three or four guests we've had all have these really interesting death row related, Dre related stories.
Totally. I'm not sure if that's totally going to hit for people because we've heard so much stuff they haven't heard yet, but we definitely talked to Corrupt and we talked quite a bit about this, and that's already out. But yeah, you know, what I'm kind of learning is I say it all the time, like, this is an underground hip hop show. Like, we're talking about like kind of like the backpack era and the things that came before it and the things that came after, but that's like kind of our bread and butter and what I really care about. But you can't ignore the actually successful artists and labels that like set up the whole tone of the industry. Like, that, we're on like the cover of so many magazines and like we're creating news and like, that the gravitational pull of this, and you cannot talk about death row without talking about like kind of gangsta rap becoming the prominent
expression of rap.
And like, you know, we talked about this directly with Corrupt. Like, I'm one of those suburban white kids who like told my dad when I was like 12 I wanted a 6'4 Impala, and he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know what I mean? Like, it's just like that imagery, that sound, that electric whistle, those bass lines, that Moog, that funk, that George Clinton is just so intoxicating. And it just like, it meant so much to so many people, and it still continues to ring bells throughout the industry of hip hop, throughout the culture. Yeah. And like, you kind of can't talk about hip hop without talking about Death Row. And like, the story is so cinematic. There's already been multiple movies made out of it. And then you come to these interesting corners of the story, and at one point they tried to sign rapper we're going to talk to in a few weeks, and like Dre, after he left Death Row, has this kind of it's more than a dalliance, it's like he signed and talked to, and we're not going to spoil the story, but like Dre prominently features in this Last Emperor interview, and if you had that on your bingo card, you're much deeper Last Emperor head than we are.
Than we were.
Yeah.
But
for me, I think of Last Emperor as like a phenomenal underground cypher style rapper from Philly who did the Secret Wars song, which was like viral before viral existed, and like something that like really, really excited me as a kid who grew up reading comic books, who was obsessed with hip hop, and just like loved the way that he laid out all of these different things, and we get to talk to him all about it, and you're going to hear it in a sec.
Absolutely. We really thank him for coming on and sharing the entire story. I, at some point, want to do a retrospective on Dre's very short, I'm okay calling it a dalliance, given what happened before and after, between the Chronics, when he tried to pivot to quote-unquote real hip-hop. It's a very... very interesting era when he had signed Razzkaz. Last Emperor will talk about his experience. Eve was part of that for a little bit. It's a very interesting chapter of hip hop, very undiscussed. But you know, that's the type of deep cuts you get here on the Dad Bod Rap Pod. So let's get into it. This is our interview with the Last Emperor, Dad Bod Rap Pod. Dad Bod Rap Pod. Every week we have conversations with people who are moving and shaping hip hop culture. This week is no different. Joining us in Zoom, we have the Last Emperor. What's happening, man?
Peace, salute. Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Good to have you on the program. Let's start at the beginning. You're a product of Philadelphia, correct?
Absolutely. So West Philadelphia, born and raised.
Born and raised. Oh, yeah. That's so cold. You get to walk around and say that for real. Yeah. That's part of your real life. So who are some of your influences when you were in your formative years as an MC, both kind of local Philadelphia influences and in the greater rap universe?
Well, since we're, I think it'd be apropos for me to say Will Smith off the bat. We went to the same high school, Overbrook High School in West Philadelphia. The same high school as like Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain from NBA fame, the first black astronaut, Guy Bluford, DJ Miz also went to my high school. The youngsters who were popping in the 90s, they went to my high school as well. But definitely Will Smith. You know, I know some people may be like, oh, but, you know, he wasn't in his heyday in the initial run of Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. Will Smith was a very formidable MC. The routines that he and Jazzy Jeff carried out in those early days of them as them being performing artists started out rocking house parties. I've seen them do local spots. Really, really a part of the initial, how shall I say, format of early MCing in which the DJ was really at the forefront of the performance, and the MC had the responsibility of highlighting rhymes around the DJ. So definitely Will Smith. I live close to what they would call the Hilltop Hustlers. So Steady B, Cool C, all EST, Three Times Dope, all those people locally definitely influenced me. And just as far as the culture all around and all together, you know, I'm old enough to remember, I think my earliest influences were like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Schoolie D, I can't forget about Schoolie D. He's also kind of like, from my area. So yeah, definitely, you know, I'm blessed enough to remember hip hop at its inception. And so yeah, all of those early guys in my neighborhood and surrounding area, as well as like, you know, the Melly Mels, you know, people like that definitely influenced me as well.
Dope, man. Thank you. You know, you mentioned Schoolie D, listening to Schoolie D, and we're gonna move forward from listening to producing your own records. And sure. you have a plethora of really good songs, but you know, I wanted to bring up the CIA song, the cut with Zach from Rage Against the Machine and KRS-One. Tell us how that came about. I mean, that's a very memorable one in your catalog, and people I know go back and revisit it, and I've brought it up. Give us the lowdown on how that came about.
Well, in the mid 90s, I started doing a showcase in New York City called the Lyricist Lounge. It was like a monthly showcase of up and coming underground MCs. They would also have like performances by artists who already had records out, but primarily a showcase for up and coming MCs and hip hop artists. So about 97, if I'm not mistaken, they approached me about being featured on a record for a tentative full length Lyricist Lounge LP that they were putting together. And they simply asked me if I was interested. I said, yes. They said, well, you know, we know you have a background in terms of political science and international relations. Would you be interested in doing something along those lines? I said, of course. And then they threw the names out. They said, would you be interested in working with KRS-One? I said, duh. No, I was like, yeah, man, of course, like Chance of a Lifetime. Now, I had, now to rewind a little bit, I had already had a couple of encounters with KRS-One in terms of like opening up for him and doing shows and stuff like that. So we were mild acquaintances. And then the icing on the cake was when they asked me also, well, we're thinking about getting some guy named Zach De La Rocha of Rage Against the Machine. Have you heard of him? I was like, yo, it was like, it was incredible because obviously as a hip hop artist and someone who's growing up listening to, you know, the traditional form of hip hop, of course, I was excited to work with KRS-One, but the icing on the cake was Zach De La Rocha. I was very familiar with Rage Against the Machine. At that time, I was, I mean, Bulls on Parade was like heavy in my rotation. So it was like a no-brainer, man. So yeah, the guys at Lyricist Lounge proposed the idea to me and I just jumped at the chance.
That's awesome. I might have this wrong, so if you could just, you tell me, please. Sure. I'm just curious. It sounds like you were going back and forth to New York, but were you also living in Philly? Were you always based in Philly?
I actually did move to Brooklyn for about, I lived there for about 7 years.
Okay, so, cool. Yeah, that helps me frame my question.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, it's only an hour and a half away, so you know what I mean? Like, I would go back and forth, you know, every, you know, whenever I wanted to see family and all that. So, but yeah, I lived in Brownsville for like 7 years.
Gotcha. Thank you. So I guess my question is, I'm really, really curious about the energy of what we call like the backpack era or like the cypher era. Like, it seems like you were really a part of that. Like, can you describe what it was like, your kind of daily life, like going around? Would you like go to Washington Square Park and rhyme? Would you always do it at showcases or where there was like an audience, or would you just rhyme on the corner? Can you just like describe what life was like for like such an active MC at the time?
Yeah, very sporadic, very sporadic. It was a time where it was definitely all about skill, like displaying your skill, honing your craft. At any given time, you'd be confronted by somebody who, even if it wasn't an overt battle, wanted to just test you and see how good you really were off stage. So definitely lots of cyphers. I have been to a few in Washington Square Park. In fact, there's kind of like this famous video that circulates of like Mos Def rhyming in Washington Square Park. I would see him there all the time. I'm not sure I might have been there the day that video was filmed, but definitely I would see people like him there a lot. But it was definitely sporadic and all about skill. Sharpening, you know, when you encounter other very talented MCs, it forces you to hone in on your craft even more and meticulously be prepared for an encounter that might mildly be like, you know, hey, let's just cipher, or someone full out saying, yo, I don't think you're as good as they say you are. I want to battle. You know what I mean? So definitely a period upon which I think, if I can be as bold as to say, in terms of the masses of MCs who were involved in the art form, that was the zenith of perfecting rhyme right. Like everybody had to be, if you wanted to really be known, you had to be a dope rhyme writer and a dope rhyme reciter. So it was very sporadic, very intense, and just a lot of fun, a lot of creativity. Some of the most creative MCs and artists, we've all, you know, encountered each other during that time. I would say, you know, definitely from the time that I emerged on the scene, the mid 90s, and definitely well into the 90s and early 2000s.
Right on. Thank you. Want to talk a little bit about your trajectory. There was a time when your name was tossed about and you were on Aftermath for a time. No, could you talk a little bit about how that came about and like what that experience was like?
Yeah, definitely. So at the same time that I'm doing the showcase, the Lyricist Lounge, starting like 96, I think I want to say like the fall of 96. I just, a year prior, I graduated from Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, with a degree in political science and international affairs. I'm pursuing hip hop kind of full fledged at this point. My close friend, comrade, brother Q, who's from Brownsville, Brooklyn, said, "Listen, man, I think you're really talented." At that point, I'd have just been doing talent shows and things of that nature and rhyming on the corner. And he was like, "Yo, I think you're really dope. We should do something with this." So we put together a demo with the help of a gentleman from South Jersey named Big Tyke. Salute to Big Tyke. And I put together like a five, six song demo in around 96, 97. Another comrade of mine who also went to Lincoln University by the name of Dame Dollars, when he graduated from Lincoln, he said, "Listen, I can't promise you anything. Oh, actually, I don't want to miss this part. I went back to my alma mater, Lincoln, to do their homecoming concert, which I opened up for KRS-One. So after the concert, my homie Dame Dollars was like, "Listen, man, I think you're incredible. I heard some of your demo. I can't promise you anything, but when I get out of school, I'm going to move with to live with my brother. I'm moving to LA. My brother does film work, Geronimo Films, and he works with Dr. Dre. I can't promise you anything, but I can promise you that I can put your demo tape into Dr. Dre's hands." We were like, "All right, cool, whatever you can do." I gave him the tape. I kind of forget about it. And then like a year later, I get a call from Dr. Dre. So,
Hold up. You just, because we're still in the 90s, right? So
yes.
Your phone rang.
Yeah.
And it was like, "Hello, this is the Last Emperor. Has Dr. Dre?" Does he just say, be like, "It's Dr. Dre"? Is that what he says?
I'll tell you, it was funny because, you know, obviously this is still in the days of landlines. And I'm home. I'm in Philly at the time. And my younger sister is like, "Yo, telephone." And I'm like, "All right, who is it?" I don't know what I was doing at the time, but I was kind of busy doing something else. And she's like, "Yo, there's some guy on the phone that says he's Dr. Dre." So I'm thinking it's, you know, I got some friends that like to, you know, play pranks and stuff like that. So I pick up the phone and I'm like, "Peace, who's this?" "Hey, yo, homie, this is Dr. Dre." I'm like, "Oh, get out of here. Is this really Dr. Dre?" And he said, "Hell yeah." I was like, "Yo." So, you know, that was it. It literally happened like that. I didn't believe him at first. And then he, you know, he did something kind of like, you know, that I would be accustomed to hearing from him on a record. So, yeah, definitely. He was like, "Yo, I heard your demo. It's really dope. Let's talk business." You know what I mean? Like, I'll have my people get in touch with whoever your lawyer is or whatever, and we'll talk have some initial conversations. He flew me and Q out to LA. And, you know, what he expressed to me was that, now, mind you, this is almost 2 years after we witnessed what happened with the lives of Tupac Shakur and the Notorious B.I.G. Obviously, at this point, Dr. Dre has left Death Row Records. Aftermath is we're in the early stages of Aftermath. And he expressed to me that he wanted to still be as funky and, you know, as dope as he's always been, but definitely explore some other forms of rhyming in terms of, you know, I'm obviously not a gangster rapper or anything like that. So basically what he was saying was like, you know, "I think you're really creative and I want to try to work with you and do something a little different than I'm accustomed to." So, yeah, man, you know, I was on Aftermath for like a year and a half, and, you know, it was a great time. It was a great time. You know, of course, at the time I was frustrated because Dre signed a ton of artists. Yeah. And kind of like, I think he didn't really know who he should really concentrate on. Now, at the time, I was a Aftermath artist, King T, Dawn Robinson from En Vogue, a couple of R&B acts, And obviously, as we all know, a gentleman by the name of Marshall Mathers. So right. we were all signed. I mean, and even these names, I mean, there's a ton, you know, tons of other artists whose names may escape me right now. Oh, Eve, who yeah. went on to have yeah. success with the Rough Riders. Definitely, man. So, you know, I got frustrated that, you know, Dre, we know now that Dre is very slow, for lack of a better term, in terms of like putting out material. He's a perfectionist. He wants to put out the best product possible. And sometimes in doing that, it seems sometimes like he's procrastinating. So, you know, I was young at the time, my career's on the line. I'm like, listen, man, I can't sit around on this label forever. And I remember it was an incident where me and Eve, we just popped up at the same time at a studio session he was having. We coordinated, called each other, was like, yo, we're both not in the studio as frequently as we would like. And we heard he was working on what would ultimately become, I guess, the Chronic 2001 or whatever.
Right.
And so we just popped up at the studio, and I think he was a little taken aback by that. So what he did was, he was like, listen, I'm going to throw on a track. Everybody gets a certain amount of time to write. And if you guys think you're that dope that you can just bust into my studio session, better come up with something dope. And I kid you not when I say, this is no disrespect to anybody else who was in that studio that day, but me and Eve represented from Philly, and we ran through every rapper that was in the studio at that point. So, you know, shortly thereafter, Dr. Dre, you know, we just approached him. I was there the same night he met Scott Storch, actually. And we both approached him and said, listen, if you're not going to move any quicker with our projects, then we may have to go somewhere else. And he respected that. You know, I have to give that. I have to credit him for that. He didn't keep me lingering for a long time. He gave me my walking papers. And, you know, but while I was there, I learned a lot. I certainly learned a lot.
Dope. Wow. Thank you for sharing that, man. You know, we mentioned a little bit about Aftermath, and we mentioned Ruckus a little bit too. And it seems like you were riding a wave of momentum and then suffered some industry sort of setbacks and delays. And I don't want to overstep, but I mean, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the debacle with Ruckus? Because, you know, Music, Magic, and Myth, I think, was highly anticipated. And then that sort of dead ended. Until you finally released it. Can you tell us a little bit about that backstory?
Yeah, it was like, you know, it just so happened at the time that I got the Ruckus, they were going through, I would say, for lack of a better term, an identity crisis. Early Ruckus prided themselves with putting out what people would call quote unquote real authentic hip hop. I like to say boom bap. You know, that's a term that KRS-One has put out into the, you know, the atmosphere. And I think that's a very appropriate term, boom bap. You know, it's a very fitting, you know, because there are different subgenres, in my opinion, of rap music being the total thing. So I'm a boom bap artist. I came through the golden age. Boom bap is what I do. Now, when I get to Ruckus, they had some success with, obviously, Company Flow and Black Star and, you know, groups like that. And so they went through a thing where they wanted to start to try to compete with Def Jam and compete with all the other larger labels. So it just so happened that when I got there, they were going through this identity crisis, like, yo, we don't want to be known as the backpack label. We want to be just as large as Death Row. We want to be just as large as Def Jam. We want to be just as large as... So it just so happened that now I had a full album complete when I got there, ready to rock and roll. I got tracks by, you know, DJ Muggs. I got tracks by, I mean, the Beat Miners. I got tracks by Prince Paul. I got tracks by Diamond D. I was ready to rock and roll. And then they hit me with, well, you know, we're looking to go into a little bit of a different direction. How about you get in with, you know, and they started coming with all these producers, and no disrespect to that, but they clearly the sound was leaning away from the boom bap that everyone was accustomed to from Raucous. So, and I've heard other label mates describe this at that time. It just so happened that, unfortunately, you know, and the straw that broke the camel's back was when they put out one of those sound bombing projects. And I had a song with the RZA, the Abbott from Wu-Tang, ready to rock and roll. I gave it to him, produced by Prince Paul. It's me and the RZA going back to back, a record called He Lives. And they wouldn't put it on there.
Wow.
You know, it was like, you know, it was like being in the Twilight Zone. So that was an indicator to me that things were like, that it wouldn't be too long left for Raucous. And case in point, Raucous is no longer here. So it's just, you know, I just fell victim to that, man. Like, you know, I think Aftermath didn't know what to do with me. And then when I get to Raucous, they're going through this identity thing. So, you know, it's just one of those things, man. Like Q-Tip said, industry rule number 4,080.
Thanks for the candor, man. Appreciate it.
They're not here anymore, but you're the last emperor. Okay, the timing of the question syncs up, so I get to ask you about Secret Wars. Do you get sick of talking about it?
Never.
Okay, never. Great. This is a audio podcast, but for the visual cue here, you are wearing a Marvel shirt today. Don't know if that's just a coincidence or not, but that shows me how true to the comic book ethos you have been. It's obviously taken over the world in that time, but if we could just do like a kind of little series of questions about it, like I guess the main thing I would like to know first is, did you ever consider when you were setting up the matchups in the song that any of the MCs would lose?
Yeah, I did momentarily. But for two reasons. I didn't want any of them coming at me when after the song was, you know, because, you know, I've encountered, you know, I've done it live in front of some of the people that are on the record, that it voices that I imitate and all that. And it hasn't always been like, yo, I really like that. You know what I mean?
I do. Yes, I've done a few imitations on here and I don't do it anymore.
Yo, so... You know, for that reason, but I mean, even more importantly, during that time, the reason that I started writing the record was A, it was just something fun to do, and B, we were going through this whole thing with the East Coast, West Coast, you know, war. So I just wanted to try to create something that was indicative of hip hop as a collective, whether you're from the East Coast, West Coast, wherever, if you're a dope MC, we can all come together and fight any formidable opponent, even if it's Stan Lee and all and his Marvel universe. You know what I mean? So that's pretty much where it came from and why I wrote the record. And just coming from a place of fun. You know, I come from an era where everybody had one or two records on their album that was like some super creative thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Secret Wars was my thing.
Yeah. It's an indisputable underground classic. I distinctly remember how exciting it was when it came out, because I think we're probably a similar age, and when you grow up reading comics like that and the little nuances that you put in about some of their like their names or like where they came from, the way that you stacked everything together, the interesting choices that you make about the matchups, and just like the way that like you complete each section and move on from it. It's just really, really masterful. And it's a great song. And curious, and when I did my research today, I hadn't listened to part two as much. And this is, I'm just going to prep you. This is really nerdy, but this is how it is on this show. It's such a slow beat. Like, why in particular that? And okay, two-part question, and I know that's not really a question, but I'm curious why you made that choice. And then the other thing is, it really seems like you can track the progression of hip hop, because in the beginning it's mostly solo artists, and in the end you're kind of taking groups, and so you can see by the way that you lined everything up how important crews had become, Rough Riders in particular.
Definitely
the Eve, which now we know a little bit more about that, and you have an amazing DMX impression.
Thank you, salute, rest in peace to DMX also. Yeah, definitely, man. First of all, the beat was not my choice. Now, unfortunately, one of the things that happened with Secret Wars Part One was that it gained such a buzz that people wanted to be a part of Secret Wars Part Two just to be a part of whatever they thought might have been the windfall from that. So I wanted to produce it myself. I had this a sample from I think More Chiba that I wanted to use. It was like a really dark, eerie, but it was a faster tempo. But, you know, at the time they were like, oh, you just, my team was just like, just stick to the rhymes. We'll take care of the production. So we got someone else to do the production. It was a super slow, dreary beat, something that I didn't particularly like. But there was a lot of political stuff going on with Secret Wars Part Two, unfortunately, which sort of took the fun out of it. You know, you're absolutely right. I wanted to also showcase, you know, some teams and crews, you know, that was becoming like more of a prevalent thing in hip hop at the time. And, you know, I just wanted to come from a place where, you know, it was like I wrote it still with that fun thing in mind, but the politics of everybody wanting to be a part of it to get whatever windfall or whatever success they thought may come from it started taking place. So, yeah, man, that's definitely Secret Wars Part Two in a nutshell.
That makes a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. And I think it's it doesn't diminish the accomplishment because it didn't go exactly how you went, right? It's just such a cool little moment in hip hop that song helps define. I guess just as a comic book fan and as an MC, like, do you think you'll ever touch that again? Like, especially because comic books have become such a part of the cultural conversation and because of the movies and TV shows and things like that. Are you ready to put that behind you and, you know, explore other subject matter?
No, I got something in the works now. It's not going to be the same thing, but it's going to be something, you know, I'm back in a space where hip hop is fun to me. Obviously, okay. I don't do it as you know, my primary source of income. It's so, you know, whatever I do at this point now, it's all from a place of fun, no politics involved. I'm just a middle-aged man who still likes to rhyme and come up with concepts. So be on the lookout for something in that vein. It's not going to be the same thing, but I trust people will enjoy it.
That's great to hear, man. And that kind of is where I was going with our last question here is,
sure.
You know, what's next? You've got a secret, not Secret Wars track coming up. You got anything else in the works that people should be on the lookout for?
Definitely. Well, the past couple of years, I've been really in my somewhat creative bag. In 2018, I put out a record, an album called Jungle Jim Season 1. And Jungle Jim was a character that I always wanted to bring to light. Pop format. He deals with action, adventure, sort of like, for lack of a better term, sort of like Indiana Jones on wax. So Jungle Jim Season 1, myself and a good friend of mine, a producer by the name of Hawk Fillmore, put out in 2018. And then in 2019, we put out another straight up Last Emperor album called Last Emperor, Lord of the Fly. So those two projects came out, and if you guys haven't heard them, I'll send you, you know, the links to it and stuff like that, and, you know, see what you guys think. And so Lord of the Fly was like the first Last Emperor album since way back when. And now this year, we're going to launch the first single around Halloween.
Okay.
The new album is going to be entitled Last Emperor and Hawk Fillmore proudly present The Wizard, The Witch, and The Wolfman.
Whoa.
So that's the new, that's going to be, that's the new album. If you like the crazy stuff I've been doing in the past, you know, I think you'll do cartwheels about this. So you guys okay. are the first, this okay. is the first format.
All right.
This is the first format that I've released that title. So you heard it here first. Last that's Emperor right, presents right. The Wizard, The Witch, and The Wolfman.
Dang, we wow. appreciate it. World premiere sneak peek here. We appreciate your time, man, and just keep doing what you do, man.
For sure. Thank you for having me. You guys keep doing what you're doing for the cause of the culture and just for, you know, nerds like us that like to listen to stuff that's fun.
Appreciate it, man. Unsurprisingly, you, man. You're a great storyteller. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, you, take man. Care.
Peace.
So that was our conversation with Last Emperor. Want to thank him for coming on.
He was and so cool, man. He was like, so he had great stories. He had great energy. He was just like, I don't know what I was expecting, but I didn't kind of know what to expect going into that interview. And I was like, I just thought he was like, so cool. That yeah, was awesome. Yeah.
Very, very forthcoming about his ups and downs in the music industry, which I always appreciate those kind of those backstories. Like, imagine going to Dre and being like, you know what, bro, this is not working out, man. I need my space. Like, whenever I hear things like that, and not to tease it too much, we'll talk to another artist who flirted with the quote unquote big time and kind of walked away from it. I always think those are super fascinating stories. But just to kind of put a cap on the Dr. Dre story we were telling before the interview. So Dre was doing this thing kind of post Death Row where he was trying to make a change in the direction. And to me, it was almost like research and development into, can you make a huge rap record that is not a gangster rap record? You clearly got the sense that Dre had a bad taste in his mouth from the abject gangsterness of Death Row Records and all the kind of things that came with that. And so he starts Aftermath. He signs a bunch of like, rapping ass rappers, like he really did. He had The Firm was a part of that, Razzkaz, Eve, even he was looking at The Last Emperor. But how does that story end? Where did he eventually land, Nate?
8 Mile part of Michigan or of Detroit. Basically, yeah. We were talking about this kind of off mic. I was like, isn't the end of the story when he signs Eminem and it's like, there's your lyricist who also checks a bunch of other boxes.
Yep.
And like yep. wasn't it's very interesting to pair shock antics with like intense lyricist
high level
hip hop, like kind of a battle yep. mentality with like a, you know, wearing dynamite in between your legs on Rolling Stone. Like it's just right, it's a really right. interesting
potent also let's hold it up in the visage of a white dude.
For sure, like, for sure.
That definitely, matters. that package was too much. I remember even hearing early Eminem stuff and just being like, yep, that's it. Like, it's a wrap. Like, he's got the game.
And he can rap his ass off. Like, no one has yeah. ever questioned his ability to rap well. And so it's an interesting thing. And he came in with a proper reverence for Dre as well, right? Yep. Like yep. he was like yep. fully willing to be produced, to be tootled. Presented.
Yeah.
To be, yeah. What did you say?
Tootled.
Tootled.
Under his tutelage.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So anyway, I think that's kind of how that story ends. I don't know if we'll ever get a peek at the vaults, but there has got to be so much good music. Like we're not perfectionists, right? I am not personally a perfectionist. You could tell, like, just looking at me, that's not my deal. It's just like good enough is good enough sometimes. And so there has to be songs that are like 98% of the way there with some of these artists that Dre signed that like we would die to hear. Right. Like,
oh yeah. I feel like a percentage of it has to be damn good. The problem is with Dr. Dre, it's got to be fucking great. Right?
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's just he only releases it once it's perfect. And I admire that as a quality. Yeah. It's fascinating. And he figured out like how to make it work for him in a way. Basically, the success level is unprecedented. But kind of want to hear some of that stuff. It's like we've had a couple of different guests come on and talk about hanging with them. Jake One comes to mind immediately, where they're just on some producer shit playing each other stuff, and like it's like, man, love to be a fly on the wall for that. Maybe we'll ascend to that level of insideriness someday. Probably not with him, probably with someone more of our generation. But anyway, Last Emperor, Marvel Comics. Got to hear all the stories about it. Got to hear, I'm fascinated with the tales of the Cypher era and what it was like to do these kind of like cutting rhymes against each other, the rhymes that make everyone just like go, oh, you know, like I'm like, I still, so there's still a part of me that really, you know, is into that and still finds that entertaining. I actually played my wife that clip that he was talking about of Mos Def in Washington Square Park. It's like the most charming verse delivery anyone could ever give. Like it's like, if it's like, you know, you don't have to be that like insidery to be like, oh, superstar. There's a superstar.
Oh, you can see it. The magnetism, the universal magnetism. you can see who he was becoming and what it means just to be. We don't talk like this on the show that often, but that's MCing, man. Mm-hmm. Like when you're holding court and you're kind of effortlessly, and you know, I think the Mos Def clip is a great example of, and he wasn't crazy misogynistic and he wasn't crazy like I'm gonna shoot you. He had some really, you know, earnest down home bars, but he's such a showman. And such an entertainer that it would just really come across, which is so interesting because to see him live now is like a shell of that. It's so weird. Like Mos has taken this like lounge singer turn in terms of his live performance. But when you see that clip, that is Mos Def at his most deafiness.
Yes. Most definitely. We've talked about him fairly extensively on the show. I have some unpopular opinions about him and his career, but I will say this. He appears from the deep outside, and I haven't listened to the podcast him and Quali and Dave Chappelle. I would like to someday. It's on some kind of platform I don't subscribe to or something, so I don't even know how to listen to it, but someday I will. And I'm really interested in him because he's one of the more compelling artists of our time, and he is someone who kind of had escape velocity from the underground hip hop scene and went on to do other things. And I find that fascinating. But what really feels apparent to me in my like kind of armchair psychology look at this is that he has been ground down by the industry.
Yeah. He's had a very interesting want to be ride.
Famous and like being famous did not work for him in sort of a similar way to Lauryn Hill. It's like, she got too famous too fast. Mm. I think she decided she did not want that. And so a lot of her decisions that she made after that, or led to this kind of like, it's like we talked about this a little bit in the show with DMC. It's something I'm fascinated by kind of personally and might want to write something about someday. Like, can you become unfamous?
The it's idea,
like how yeah. do you lessen your notoriety and your visibility and stop doing so much great stuff. So
you change your name. That's number one. Mos Def had the best rap name in history, in my opinion. Yeah. You change your name, and Mos Def is doing this thing because I have heard a little bit of the Midnight Miracle. I think they were posting like a clip on Instagram. He does this thing where he's adopted this accent that is neither New York. It sounds slightly European, a little bit African. I compare it to when Tina Turner started having a British accent all of a sudden in the 80s. Like, she just came out as like this kind of regal diva voice. Like, he has some, this like, he's doing this character, or maybe that's just him now, that is so far from where he started. And maybe it is this idea of becoming unfamous and like having seen the industry from a particular idea. I think he's like the rap version of Steel, if you know what I mean, who literally cut his face to become supposedly unfamous. Didn't work.
Is that why? I guess I don't know that story about Seal.
Yeah, Yeah, he marred his face because he was like a male model type and people wouldn't take his music seriously.
Wow.
So he did something to his face to kind of scarify his face.
He did that on purpose.
Okay. If I'm wrong about that, I'm going to get ratioed, but I do believe that is real.
All right. I have some stuff to look up when we're done recording here. I don't know any of this. Like, okay. To me, Seal is like the Kiss from a Rose guy, and he was married to Heidi Klum, and it's basically where it stops for me.
He's so funny though.
And pop star. Like, I don't know that much about him.
He disfigured his face and was still more attractive than most of us in pull. You know what I mean? It just goes to show.
Yeah, no.
I did not expect us to end up with Seal at the end of a Dad Bod Rap Pod, but you never know where it's going.
You never know. You might just go to the mall, end up in a wet Seal. I don't know.
And on that note, we want to thank everybody for tapping in. You can connect with us on Twitter at Dad Bod Rap Pod, on IG at Dad Bod Rap Pod. We drop new episodes every Thursday.
And the occasional Monday. You got to watch out for those.
We might hit you with a surprise Monday.
Might get a mini app, just a bonus.
We doing so much podcasting, bro. Like, I'm tired of me talking, but
Won't stop.
People are definitely letting us know that they're enjoying the program, and we appreciate your patronage. And yeah, we'll be back next week with more dope interviews, more dope conversation. We are the Dad Bod Rap Pod.